There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hi, I'm Anand Patel.
And I'm Naomi Sheldon.
And we're your hosts of the Pleasure Podcast. I'm a doctor specialising in sexual function.
And I'm an actor-writer with an interest in the intimate. We want to fill the gap in the nation's sex and relationship education through interviewing guests on how we relate to our bodies when it comes to sex, identity, and of course, pleasure. It's the finale of season four.
Thank you to all our guests and pleasure podders for making this a brilliant season. We've reached more people than ever before.
We love our growing community and are thrilled to know you're as passionate as us when it comes to talking about pleasure. I'm taking a break to have my babies, but we'll be back in January with a brand new season.
Don't worry, there's a juicy archive of episodes to explore, so please dig in. But now for our finale guest, and this really is a special one.
It's international changemaker, Black Pride co-founder, MBE rejecting, aptly named, Lady Phil. Phil Opoku-Gima co-founded UK Black Pride.
She's the exec director of Kaleidoscope, a trust supporting LGBTQ plus activists around the world, and she successfully campaigns for the better treatment of people of colour in the LGBTQ plus community.
This year, she was voted number 4 on the Pride Power List. This is a gloriously personal conversation where we discuss the genesis of UK Black Pride and Phil's search for intimacy after her marriage ended and she was able to fully explore her sexuality with women. She shares the emotional connection found in her first sexual experience with a woman, which allowed her to be seen in the most profound way, as well as her thoughts on polyamory and having sex that allows for vulnerability rather than performance.
Not ignoring, of course, the simple joy of fucking. In a Zoom miracle in under an hour, the three of us fell in love. We hope you do too.
I grew up in London for a little bit, lived on this wonderful council estate called Woodbury Down in Manor House, and we moved quite a bit because my parents came to this country, I would say, as, you know, working migrants from Ghana. And we were then in Edmonton, and I remember my mum and dad saying, we want you to take this test to go to one of the best schools ever. And I was hating the fact that I'd have to do that because it was a school which was predominantly white. Took the test, and then I got moved out to Hertfordshire, where I spent the majority of my time in a school which I was the only black kid there for three and a half years. And yeah, I think when people say, oh, what was your coming out experience or journey at that time? I wasn't coming out as LGBT plus then. I was coming out as black constantly because of what I had to navigate, what I had to deal with, the sort of systemic racism that existed at a time, you know, I'm heading towards my 50s now. So at a time which felt quite hostile. And then, yeah, I left Hertfordshire and then came straight back into London.
Was that a big relief, suddenly coming back to London and being so surrounded by people of all different ethnicities rather than being in such a white school?
It was. But, you know, I found that I spoke a certain way, whatever that was, and I was never black enough for my black friends. Mm. And I was too black for my white friends. So it just felt like, oh, you can't win. And everyone looks for this place to belong, don't they? We all look for, whether it is about intimacy or whether it's about pleasure, whether we are into fetish stuff or whether we're into knitting, whatever it may be, we're all looking for a place to be. So, you know, I found myself searching, doing a lot of soul searching for who I am. And I found myself in this relationship, which was a bit toxic and volatile, but one great thing came out of it. You know, I have a daughter who's 25. I know, I look 25 myself.
That's true.
It's very true.
Yeah, that's the one great thing that came out of it. I think from a young age, I knew something was different about me. But when you come from a family that is religious, that Christianity plays a big part, and it's always about not bringing shame to the family, you tend to conform to what the norm or the societal norms seem to be. So, I think I suppressed for quite a long time a part of me, and then I came out 20 years ago.
So when you were growing up, were there any representatives of sort of the LGBTQI community that you felt like, oh, actually, I can see myself in them?
So I think like my first nightclub was a place called Hemel in Hemel Hempstead. And I was there and I was like, oh my gosh, I can't believe I'm surrounded by so many women and women that just seem free to be who they are. You know, you had your butch white women, you had your stud like black women, you had your femme or your lipstick lesbian, whatever it was. And I felt like I was everyone there because it was just so liberating to be in a space that you have a shared commonality with somebody. But then I realized it was predominantly white. So you start to look for people that look like you, that, you know, will understand some of the same struggles. And coming into London, you know, you'd hear of people like Linda Bellos, and regardless of her politics at the moment or what one thinks of it, you can't take away from the politics and the path that she paved for black lesbian women at a particular period, being the first, you know, local councillor in Lambeth. Then there was Femi Otadjou, who was the first black woman to be part of the London Lesbian Gay Switchboard. You had Monica Beadle, Veronica McKenzie. So I was starting to find all of these black women and thinking, oh my gosh, I'm not the only one. You see so many women that had come before you, and you start to ask them stories of their journeys.
It's funny, I went to a queer nightclub, I think it was last year, wasn't it, Anand, that I went, and I felt, I enjoyed it so much, but I also felt like, because I hadn't grown up, so I'm married, but I am bisexual, and because I hadn't grown up necessarily being out, I felt like being in this club, I was frightened in the sense of, sorry, not frightened of other people, of myself, really.
I understand that word frightened and being in that space, not that someone's going to come and attack you. The fear of, oh, something's new.
Yes, absolutely. And that I felt like I hadn't learnt the language growing up, like I felt like I've been so in the male gaze for so long about how to dance, how to be attractive, how to, you know, how to flirt even. And I felt like suddenly I was in this new world where I haven't learned how to behave. I know that sounds false somehow, but it made me realize that I'd missed out on so much from my teenagers, those informative years that just weren't open to me. And I was wondering whether it felt at all, although similar for you, even though obviously it was a huge relief to find that space finally, whether, you know, coming into it in your 30s, I suppose, you must have been in your 30s, maybe, late 20s, whether there was a similar thing there. How do I work in this space?
Well, I love the way you put it about, you know, being frightened and, you know, hadn't learned how to dance or behave. I think it's something about unlearning the ways in which we are often conforming to that societal norm. And, you know, you'll hear me say conforming quite a lot because I think that's something we fall into so naturally. So, yeah, I think for me, just being in a space that meant I could start peeling off some of those layers of where I had not really been so authentic. I was not being truthful to myself about what I wanted, how I wanted it, you know, that I wanted to experience women in the fullest. I wanted to sit down and eat and talk and be intimate and connect with them on a different way that I was so used to, a connection that had felt forced with men. But it was what society said was the right thing to do, because you fall into this heteronormative way of living and then it becomes so binary, doesn't it? So it felt good.
Yeah. Good.
But it's the backlash that comes afterwards with it, because, you know, you have to not just deal with the fact that you're feeling empowered and emboldened to take particular steps and you feel that sense of beautiful connection to other women. But how do you explain that to those around you who are in that sort of heteronormative world of how we live?
You mentioned that you came from a relatively conservative religious background. Is that part of what imposed its values on your thoughts and behaviours, say, in your late teens, 20s?
I would say so. You know, you grow up going to church, and when somebody of influence and power is constantly telling you how you live your life, that is what you do. Just like adult child parent scenario, I am the one who has influence and power about how my daughter's going to live her life. So, you know, if I wag my finger and tell her that is really, really bad every time you touch that black purse, that is ingrained and embedded in her mind that you don't touch the black purse. I mean, I was always a bit of a rebel. So I was, I call it the white sheep of the family. I don't call it the black sheep of the family, you know. And my parents said that I'm going to be the one to bring so much shame on the family. There you have it. I made them proud, you know.
Was there a sort of a reckoning or a resolution for you with your parents, or a difficult transition?
You know, I often stay away from, and maybe because I'm comfortable with you two, but I often stay away from how I talk about the resolution between my mother and myself, especially because I'm a daddy's girl and, you know, I can do no wrong in his eyes. But my mother, I think because of how she's grown up herself, coming to this country and, you know, having to deal with difference, she's at tolerance stage. And this is like 20 plus years on and she's at tolerance stage. And this is generational. And some of this, you know, links to my very own work that I do with Kaleidoscope Trust about the laws and the legislations that are in countries in Africa, Asia, the Caribbean, which are colonial era laws imposed and put there by the British. So my mum has grown up knowing that it is a crime or it is a shame and you will bring dishonour on your family if you are falling into this Sodom and Gomorrah, you know, lifestyle of trying to say you love the same sex person as yourself. So yeah, I've come to acceptance. So the resolution for me is that I'm no longer angry. I'm not hurt. The disappointment has lessened because I, as an adult now, I really understand that some of this is about unlearning. And, you know, we can learn lots of things. We can go to university and learn tons. But to unlearn bad behaviours, like what we're seeing in today's history, you know, people have to unlearn. They are or can be the potential to be racist. So, you know, the unlearning. And also in my language, there is no word that describes lesbians and gays and bisexual and trans people unless it's derogatory.
Wow, so, that's fascinating.
That's a big key factor of how people of colour who are often from Asian backgrounds or African or Caribbean, maybe Creole speaking or Portuguese speaking, sometimes there's no word, definitive word, unless it is derogatory, and then you end up claiming that word to describe sexual orientation or sexuality.
And I recognise that very much from what you say. My dad, who is a lovely man, was, you know, sort of culturally homophobic, if that makes sense. Sort of, it was just how everyone behaved. My dad was a very masculine man's man, a bodybuilder, and all of these things. And those sort of archetypes really dragged through into his beliefs. And so his idea of a sort of manly chat with me would be telling me about how attractive Pamela Anderson's knockers were and about how I should use condoms and stuff. I was like, oh, okay, I'll take half of that conversation away with me. Thanks, Dad.
But the knockers,
well, basically, yeah. but as time progressed, you know, I mean, it took a long time for my dad to sort of meet my partner. And so everyone else in the family, the first meeting with my family I took him to was a small wedding of 300 people. And actually, my cousin was marrying her husband. And I said, look, do you mind if I bring Matt? And she was like, oh, thank God. Anything, I'm marrying a black man, honey. Anything to take away from the challenge that's going to be my wedding.
Yeah.
And it was fascinating. And anyway, we went to that wedding and there were so many interesting dynamics. I mean, partly they were wondering who the hell is this white man that's walked into this wedding, because everyone else was a person of colour. But it also was within that people of colour, there was black people and there was sort of Asian people. And it was quite segregated and their behaviours were different. And there were people eating chicken out of the back of a van in one corner. And then there were others eating samosas. And it was just going. So he didn't come to that wedding because Matthew was going there. And it's taken a while for him to warm up. But now we stayed with my dad in India this year for the first time, and it was wonderful. And he hugged Matthew and he asks about Matthew now, and it's, I think we've got to the point that it's more than tolerance, it's sort of acceptance and kindness, which I think
beautiful.
Is really lovely, really lovely. Yeah. So I'm really grateful for you sharing that about, you know, the difficulties that you've had.
Yeah, and this is the very reason why UK Black Pride was created. Because people say, oh my gosh, you know, the black community, the BAME community, hard to reach. It's not that we're hard to reach, it's that we have different sets of challenges that when you look at prides in general, they have very much been quite patriarchal, you know, very male, very white, very cis. And it didn't look at the various challenges that black and brown communities faced, like the history of whether it was slavery to colonization, to language, to diction, to families, to religion, to belief and faith, to colorism, or even the anti-blackness, as you just mentioned, within the Asian community and the African Caribbean community. Prides never really look at those various intersections. So when creating an event or a movement or a pride, it's got to be intersectional. Otherwise, you end up erasing parts of who people are. And then they don't feel like that's the space or the place for them to belong.
Would you mind just telling me a bit about the sort of history and herstory of UK Black Pride?
So UK Black Pride, I get excited talking about it, but it's also been a labour of love. It's not just a moment, just like Black Lives Matter is not just a moment, as some parliamentarians would have you think. It is absolutely a movement, because we've brought together different parts and different facets of our communities, which is not just about celebrating, which of course that's so important to have a space that we can celebrate, but we remember pride in its form that it was about, you know, Sylvia Rivera, Marsha P. Johnson, Stormé Delaware, talking about enough is enough around police brutality, you know, Latino X and Black and African American women, gender non-conforming people were challenged by the police brutality, the lack of housing, the lack of education, the lack of even the safe spaces to protect them. And when you look at today's society, of course, we've come a long way, but there is still those components that are compounded by how we live. So Black LGBTQ people, whether it's around youth homelessness, and, you know, you can look at stats coming from the Albert Kennedy Trust, over 66% of their service users happen to be Black and Asian minority ethnic. That's terrible. You know, and then you look at what's happening with trans people, our trans siblings right now, the vitriol, the propaganda and the nasty shit that's being thrown their way when literally they just want to survive and live. And I think in the last 2 weeks, and of course this is linked to America, but the last 2 weeks, you have had six murders of trans women of colour. You know, and on the 20th of November, every year we mark and commemorate trans people who have had their lives taken from them all too quickly. But 85% of that list happens to be trans women of colour. It shows you that for UK Black Pride, where we're coming from is about challenging the homophobia, biphobia, transphobia and Islamophobia, but also the racism, which is structural and systemic, not just outside in society, but within our own LGBT plus communities, because that is a real factor of, you know, what spaces we get to navigate, what spaces we're included in. And UK Black Pride, I think, has changed the tide of things. We are certainly, you know, from 2005, where we started off in Southend for 200 people being told that there will never be a Black Pride in this country, to 2019 and seeing 10,000 people descend on Haggerston Park and occupy and claim their space and connect with people as if that was their chosen family, because many of us may have been ostracized or marginalized by family members. It feels like that's the right thing. It feels like it is something we can take pride of place in. It feels like it's home. It feels like we can dance and sing and cry and do it all together in a way that we feel lifted and we feel held. And that's what prides are supposed to be about, as well as remaining political and putting people over profits.
And that also plays a part in how it's sponsored as well, isn't it? I seem to remember that it's very carefully sponsored and curated in that way.
Absolutely. I mean, anyone that organises a pride knows that it costs a lot of money, especially if you're a free pride like London Pride or UK Black Pride. You know, the logistics, the dynamics, the safety, the well-being, the police and the fire brigade, the transport for London, all of that costs money to make sure you hold a safe pride. So you require sponsors that are going to give to you that allows you to put on this event. However, what we say, and I'll say speak specifically about UK Black Pride, we're not going to centre those sponsors in our pride. What we are asking them to do is play their good part in being an ally and making sure that their staff networks, if they are LGBT, if they're BAME or Black or POC, that they come and they take pride of place, but they will not be front and centre of a pride, a Black Pride, that was built and created by us and for us, because we need to be centred, because quite often, you know, history has taught us that we're not valuable, yes. We're not yes. respected.
There's something I really found charming about your description about the beginnings of UK Black Pride, and you and a few sort of co-founders headed to Southend in a series of buses. So you're going on this little trip, and it struck me that this was a sort of it was a bit of a road trip. But I can't even imagine the sort of the shock or surprise that Southend must have had about your arrival on the beach.
I remember the faces.
I mean, what was it like just being there in that sort of moment?
Yeah, I mean, what I should explain is that in 2004, I was running with two other people, an organisation called BLUK, B-L-U-K, Black Lesbians in the UK. And that was our first road trip to Southend, because Southend, Broadstairs, Margate, those were my holiday places, because that's where my parents could afford to take us. When we descended on Southend, Shrewsbury Ness, to be exact, we were met with faces of horror and disbelief, because we've got a couple of busloads of primarily Black lesbians and Black bisexual and Black trans women getting off this bus to a space where you could see the sea. It was beautiful, and some people had never travelled outside of London. You know, they've come straight off from the airport to being in a house in London and not connected or met anyone else. But when we got there, people were standing round. And obviously somebody must have called a couple of their friends, because we had a group of white guys that I don't want to generalise, but reflected and reminded me back of my days in Hertfordshire, the BNP. You know, they had the bomber jackets on and the DMs, and it almost felt like they had come to start something. But I kid you not, we had so much power in our collective beings and being in that space that we turned that volume up, and there was no way that anyone was going to infiltrate, anyone was going to try and dismantle or destroy what we had created, because we don't get that opportunity often to hold spaces and to hold each other. So it was like, fuck you, you are not coming to mess with our shit, because we are going to tear you down if you try to. So yeah, you know, we remember the look, but we also remember what it meant to be surrounded by each other.
Huh. The power of that community. That's amazing.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
And I also found challenging sort of the difficulty, you mentioned it slightly earlier, about the power dynamics within the LGBTQIA structure, where you were trying to just have a bit of space, but actually there were segments of that community that were kind of going, actually, there's no room for you. That must have been so difficult.
I think that was probably the most hurtful thing, knowing that, you know, people within the LGBT plus community who had often understood what marginalization, oppression means because of one's sexuality, sexual orientation, you know, from Section 28 to, you know, not being seen in the streets or being seen in the streets and being attacked just because they are LGBT. You can't quite comprehend why somebody wouldn't understand that, you know, the intersection between race and gender and class and sexuality, sexual orientation is all part of how we see our lives. So being told there would never be a Black Pride in this country was a complete dismissal or erasure of us as Black and brown people. We would get told, why don't you just join the normal, quote unquote, normal pride? I mean, I don't know what normal is, but I do know that we just don't fall into particular spaces and we're not just accepted. You know, there's a long history of this. And I always keep on talking about the history, because in order to understand why UK Black Pride is here, you have to understand the historical context to how racism plays out. We are not just LGBT people. We are not just women. We are not just disabled. We are not just young. We're not just migrants. We're not just refugees. We're not just Black people. We are so many different things that make up who we are that, you know, when someone says, oh, what do you fight for first? You can't make that distinction. I can't divorce myself from being an African lesbian woman. You know, if I took away the lesbian, then am I not erasing a part of who I am and silencing that part to just fight for Black rights? And that's why when we talk about Black Lives Matter, we've also got to say all Black Lives Matter, whether they are queer Black lives, trans Black lives, whether they're disabled Black lives. And I can go on and on and on because I think that this is the unlearning that a lot of us have to do in understanding spaces, the parallels of history back then and also today, the sort of synergies that we can make, and really, what does true allyship look like if you are not Black or non-POC, that you're going to support in a meaningful way and not a performative, tokenistic way?
We had an amazing conversation with Wild Iris, who was a person of colour sex worker. And she was talking about how when she went to LGBT spaces, she didn't feel there was a place for her there. She felt very excluded. And she felt that the strongest degree of exclusion was from white gay men. And I sort of questioned, going, why would that be? And she said, well, they just don't have their full privilege and they're really pissed off about that. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't have the full privilege of the heterosexual white male. So actually, they want to hold the alpha level of the gay world. And actually, then there's no space. And you know, whether that's true or not, certainly for her, it felt true. And certainly I felt a bit of that when I've been in that place. So I can fully feel how excluded people can be because, you know, of their own hurts. I mean, I recognise that actually the white LGBT community will have had their own sort of negative experiences based on, you know, their sexuality, etc. But there is an intersectionality that takes that further, I believe.
Privilege is something that needs to be explored and understood in its fullest. And we all have, you know, just by virtue of us being on this call right now, we all have a kind of privilege. Of course, there's white privilege, which has been the superior and the dominating factor. But as a Black African woman who was born in the UK, that's job is to travel around the world to look at how we uphold human rights for LGBT plus people. I also have a privilege over those who I set out to serve. I have a passport that takes me to 100 odd countries without a visa. You know, I can travel and move around. I have a house, I have a car. Those could be seen as privileges, but when you then make the comparison and the distinction about white privilege, you have to go back and understand that white privilege has been such an entitlement because our white brothers and sisters and siblings have benefited off the backs of Black labour for so long that they don't even realise that it's a privilege. And when you talk about privilege, I think sometimes people, you know, get uncomfortable or they get guilt, they feel guilty. And I say, you know, guilt serves no purpose. It's so self-indulgent. But let's be uncomfortable at the privileges you have and think of ways to ensure you use that wisely and correctly to amplify others that don't have the same level of access you do to good health, to education, to housing, to so many different things. And I hope that I even use my small privileges that I have in the right way when helping, you know, human rights defenders in the global south that can't even travel and don't even know where their next meal is going to come from or how they're going to support their other civil society colleagues or comrades in a climate of COVID. So I think that I have learnt, and I'm not saying this is the right way, but I have learned that I always understand that what I have is absolutely great and I'm grateful for it all. But I also know that there are so many others that don't have that. And maybe that's one of the many great things my parents have instilled in me, from coming to this country to constantly talking about wanting a better life for their children, sending me to a bloody school where I was the only Black person that drove me crazy. But they wanted good for me so that I can in turn make sure my children and my children's children also had good. They were fighters. They were the beacons of education because they knew that that would help you navigate the world in a particular way. And I'm now able to do that in my work. I wish I could do it as greatly in my relationships. But, you know, I like to know that I am changing I'm a change maker. I like to believe that I am doing my bit to leave a legacy, that when my daughter comes to taking up that baton, that she can stand up for the next generation that comes after her as well.
Mm. Wow. She must be very, very proud of you and vice versa.
Sometimes.
Can I just mention, sorry, I wanted to mention this book, so Sister, which is an anthology that you contributed to, and particularly talking about UK Black Pride, which we've discussed, which was lovely. And it's a fantastic book. I mean, it's a really good book. It sort of deals with so many aspects, such as the politics of black hair and the silence of families to sexuality, the importance of reputation and behaviour, the wonder of being seen and represented on TV, sort of love and loss and redemption, the challenges of being a black lesbian with a white partner, and waking up and thinking in bed with them, actually, you don't know me and you'll never know me. That's part of my experience that you'll never achieve and never reach. So, I mean, it's a wonderful thing to have been able to sort of access and read, because it gives you a point of view that I don't really hear about. I mean, I'm a gay man and I recognise that in LGBT, I hear a lot more from the G. and I just wondered about how you felt about the fact that the L was, for my world, felt relatively quiet and silent.
The book, I, not just a contributor, I co-edited it, because there are two men who co-edit it with me that maybe sometimes, Ricky and John, who are amazing, but I always stress that I was a co-editor, because you don't often find black lesbian women who are editors of books. The L is often silenced, but also so is the B, especially in our communities. And I think that is an admission of guilt that we all play, because people describe prides as, oh, gay pride, or, oh my gosh, that person's gay, when actually they may not be gay, they may be bisexual, they might be bi-curious, they may be questioning, they may be, non-binary, oh, they're gay. And gay is a word that's thrown about that sort of tries to encompass everybody. But I love how you've read that book, because it talks about everything from hair to interracial relationships, same gender loving women. It says so much. There's poems about our blackness and how we're not centered. And, you know, there's stories about home. And I say home back in Africa or the Caribbean that play out about how we navigate our world when we're here in the UK. So there's so much. The book is powerful. And in a time like this, where people are looking for resources and understanding how they can understand racism and the dynamics better, pick up the Sister anthology. You know, I didn't even have to give that shameless plug. You did it. You did it for me.
I genuinely really, really enjoyed it, because obviously there are themes that travel the world, and they're transhuman, aren't they? The experience about being alone, or feeling excited about a potential relationship, or about feeling loss, or feeling that you could redeem yourself, or all of these things that are so important, and particularly what it was the warmth of female sexuality. Mm. And what particularly struck me was the title you chose. Because it specifically says same gender loving women. Yeah. And that was interesting to me, because when in my world, because I work in sexual function, the sort of term is men who have sex with men. Mm-hmm. It's not about relationships, it's not about love.
It's MSM, yeah.
And so it was intriguing to see sort of SGLW, if we're going to go for our acronyms, yes, versus MSM. And I found
I'd never heard, this phrase before.
Yes, the same gender loving women is... Some of us don't subscribe to the word lesbian, but we do talk about being lovers of women, you know. Mm-hmm. And I remember when I was telling my mum in my 7-page letter when I was coming out that I'm a woman who loves women, because I couldn't put down the word lesbian, because she doesn't understand or subscribe to that word at all. But it has something so beautiful about saying loving women, you know, and we can we can love women in many different ways. You know, I've fallen in love with you already, you know, you told me. And we can love, of course I love you too, I'm not excluding, but you know
thanks,
before you start getting all patriarchal on me and saying it's got to be about me. But, you know, there's a connection that women have with each other. And we can look up, we can watch the TV and say, oh my gosh, she's beautiful, she's stunning. I just absolutely, you can desire somebody without having to want to touch them or without wanting to be, you know, physically sexual with them. You can be intimate, even in your mind, with another woman. I can sit here and talk to you for ages because we're going to have a connection about our experiences of being women. And our experiences of not being seen as the top of the ladder, of often being seen or not seen, I should say. So I love saying I'm a lover of women.
Because it also releases any, I don't know, prejudices, or I mean, I think we should absolutely own the word lesbian, absolutely. Mm-hmm. But same gender loving women does release us from prejudices that we might have had inbred in us as well, or assumptions, or maybe, I think using the word loving actually is so useful. and honest,
yeah,
as well.
But it strikes me though, if you had MLM, so men who love men, I think it would feel more challenging, and I find that odd.
Oh, that's interesting, because maybe, and just unpicking that slightly, maybe men loving men seeming odd to you. I think it's beautiful, but I think that there's something about that that breaks down the stigma that men who have sex with men are promiscuous. For me, same gender loving women is about love in its many different forms. Whether that love took place around just having sex, but that sex was about lovemaking, and then, you know, she pissed off afterwards, we still had a love moment. It was, you know, yeah. I think the word love is a beautiful one, and we think that if we love somebody, oh, it's got to lead to marriage. Whereas, actually, you can love someone in the moment.
I totally agree. And it's a bit of a journey I feel I've been on as well. Over the past sort of 5 years, really, about love and intimacy with friends and knowing. I suppose I find it difficult to talk about because I'm still on that journey, actually. So I haven't got a conclusion. it sort of feels quite amorphous. And the desiring and the friendship, quote unquote friendship, because actually it can be quite sensual. And those boundaries are starting to melt. And so it makes one think about, you know, sexuality a lot. And, oh, well, if I'm desiring this person in this way, what does that mean for the friendship? Or what does that mean for my sexuality? And can I satisfy myself with just simply the desire? Or does it have to be physicalised? Mm-hmm. What happens if you then physicalise it? And what happens to the friendship or the relationship after that? It's interesting. It feels like it's very fluid.
I don't know why I'm grinning so much. I'm grinning like a Cheshire cat because I'm like, yes, yeah. I like want to pick my fingers. I think part of the journey, because even myself, I'm on a journey and it will never, ever stop. It's when you feel like there has to be a conclusion that's what you're working towards, whereas don't make it so fixed. Mm. You know, I am understanding what it means more to be polyamorous at this precise moment in my head. And I'm reading lots of different books, I'm speaking to other people, and I'm like, oh, right, that sounds really interesting. Because I've got to a stage where I'm not sure I believe I can love just one person. But then that's just me. I mean, look, he sat there thinking, oh, Matt, you know, I love Matt. But, oh, yes, actually, I could love. And I also think that one person is... Oh, this is not good to say, or is it good to say? Yeah, I'm not sure one person is enough for me. And I don't think that I'm just enough for one person. I'm not going to give somebody everything they desire. And why
should you? And why should they? That what a huge responsibility to place on a person, that they must be everything to you.
Yeah. I love beautiful relationships where they have found that and they've got married or they're in a beautiful place. I have so many friends who are, you know, women and women who are married, home, the cat, the plant, everything's there and it's all set up and they're happy. But I realise that maybe that happiness of what I'm searching for, because I am still searching and I'm on that journey, what I'm searching for is not the heteronormative way of I've got to meet somebody, desire them, we have this lust and then we fall in love and then we think about what the future looks like and then we sort of move in together and then we sort of think about, you know, marriage or, you know, whatever that looks like. Why can't it just be that you might have multiple relationships where somebody's there that stimulates your mind in a particular way where you can be political and, you know, not be called aggressive or angry and have that conversation. And then there might be somebody who, oh my gosh, you know, you don't want them to talk. You just want to have sex with them because they are so damn frigging hot. And, you know, just shut up. Please don't say a word. Don't say a word. Let's just have sex, you know. Yeah. And then there might be somebody who allows the sensitive me to come out, the vulnerable, and also me understanding what patience looks like, what beauty looks like by being open and letting down some of those guards. And to date, I've never met one woman that has, oh, look, the exes are going to be listening to this thinking, she had it, but she didn't look after it. But I've never met one woman who has been able to give me all of that, or that I've even been able to give all of that to.
And that really resonates with what I've found. And I've been in a relationship now for 11 years, and I've had to evolve my understanding of what relationships are. I've had to recognise that I can have a crush on some of my friends. And actually, because I'm opening myself up in terms of being more intimate and being able to have conversations that I previously would have thought more challenging, that level of intimacy, you kind of go, where is this going? As both of you attended to going, oh, this is going somewhere a bit funny. And you can either feel very uncomfortable with that and then, you know, retract back from that. Or you can kind of just go, look, you know, I love my partner and I'm going to have a very sort of mind intimate friendship with this person, and I can still love them and adore them and think they're incredible. I make the choice that I won't be physically, you know, intimate with them, but, you know, who knows in the future? You know, Matt, don't listen. But I think the issue is about feeling that you can have these crushes, feeling that you can be intimate without having that sense that you're going to be judged. Or that it's a really bad thing for you to actually have like more than one partner. Judgment. And it's the moral judgment of going, yeah, there's a primacy of one person. I mean, actually, I do believe for me, a relative primacy of one person. I can only love one person the maximum, and that's about it. But I can like and love parts of other people.
There's nothing wrong with, you know, we talk about alternative families and alternative relationships. I know people who have been in relationships for years, and actually they may be swingers, or they may have, you know, a kind of open relationship that is not necessarily polyamorous, but is allowing them to have dialogue and conversation and go out to meet other people. And it may not be sexual, you know. So I think we're a society that is ever so judgmental. That's why, you know, when we say the word polyamory, we kind of whisper it. Or I even feel for my bisexual and bi-curious siblings that they often have to say, yeah, I'm bisexual. Whereas don't whisper it, shout it from the rooftops. And there's nothing wrong that you feel attracted to both men and women, or even non-binary or gender fluid people. I think let's find a different way of shaping the narrative that allows us to be open and much freer about who we choose to love or be intimate with, or who we just want to fuck, you know. Whatever it is, yeah.
I was wondering what those sort of early relationships were when you first started seeing other women. Coming to it a little bit later, how was that?
I'm a very sensual person. Yeah. And I I'm quite deep and I'm an overthinker, and I could be intimate with my pillow and, you know, talk to it in a way. I love words. So I think when, oh, and I remember that first person, it was an experience that felt so right, like it was meant to be, not with her that it was meant to be, but it felt so right that it was meant to be with another woman.
Yeah.
There was a softness, there was a connection, there was a realness that I hadn't experienced from where I had dated or had intimate relationships with men. And there was, I think the word I would say, a connection when we touched.
Mm-hmm.
Because she knew what my body and my mind and my soul required in that moment of needing to be loved from my head to my toe. That was my coming of dawn. And I was like, oh my gosh, if this is what it feels like, what have I been waiting for so long? Why did I hold that back? And, you know, being a lesbian is not about the sexual act, but it's all part of it. And I find it hard to describe that feeling because it's right here in my core. It's a feeling that has tingled me from my head to my toe. It's a feeling that has made me feel pleasure in so many different ways. It's a feeling that you want more of because it feels right.
Some people, when they, for example, first experience sex with the, you know, the partner they find attractive, etc., they feel a sense of shame alongside that joy and feeling of right. Did you have any of that sense at all? Was it just that sense of rightness?
No, I don't think shame came into it. Maybe shame when coming out to others, because that felt difficult because of where their mindsets were. But if we're talking about that intimacy and connection, no, there was no shame. I think that there was a built-up tension of not knowing that this is what it felt like. So I think the first time I experienced an orgasm with a woman, it was like, oh my gosh, I cried. I literally cried because I didn't know that's what it would feel like.
I feel very emotional hearing what you're saying, because I really relate to it. And, oh, it's actually making me cry. I'm also heavily pregnant, by the way, so I'm quite emotional generally. But having sex with women, there's something about, for me, about it that has been about being seen. And again, very hard to describe, but that sort of feeling of being seen and understood and about communication in a way that often with heterosexual relationships that I've had has been more about sort of performance or how I wish to be seen, as opposed to being very vulnerable, actually, and very open. And it's very special. And of course, it's not always like that. It doesn't always have to be tender and communicative and seen, you know, it can be, you know, of course. But those really poignant moments where you feel like you've got your heart out on a plate, ultimately, and it's a relief.
Yeah. And you're allowed to be emotional. You don't ever, ever apologize for being emotional. Be unapologetic. It's okay to cry. It's okay to laugh. And, you know, I know what pregnancy is like. My hormones are all over the place. But trying to explain a feeling that we felt is often difficult to do so. And sometimes we just know. Sometimes, you know, all you've got to say is, it just felt so real.
Yeah.
And then we just know, it, regardless what type of relationship you're in, we just know that that feeling felt right at that precise moment. And, you know, we should also point out that sex and lovemaking and intimacy can also be quite raw and gritty. Sex is not always cute, depending on what you do and how you decide to be intimate or sexual with each other.
From my point of view, I think it's healthy because I spend so much time trying to be proper and appropriate and say the right thing and not get things wrong that I kind of want to let that go a bit. That is actually how I feel. And I feel so much of the time the pressure not to say how I feel.
I love how open you two are. This is great. I feel really comfortable. Yeah. And I'm like, you know, I don't often get the chance to be Phil and to talk about, you know, sex intimacy. But I love the fact that we're speaking and I'm Phil. You're not speaking to Lady Phil. And I know that sounds like in the third sense, because Lady Phil has this persona that, like you were just saying, have to be proper and have to be, you know, a little bit conservative in what I do say, how I do say it, you know. So, yeah, I've really welcomed this conversation. See, it's happened at the right time. All those cancellations and moving it about, I needed this conversation right now.
Find out more about Phil's work with UK Black Pride, the Kaleidoscope Trust, and her anthology sister from the links in the show notes.
Thank you for listening to the Pleasure Podcast.
If you enjoy this, do share, review, and subscribe on iTunes.
It really does help other people find us and helps to give the series a boost. Please do give us 5 stars.
Thank you to Acast for hosting us,
Matt Peaver for editing us, Ollie Birch for the music,
Gilad Visotsky for the graphics.
Join us next time when we interview another guest for their insights on the relationship we have to our bodies, sex, and of course, pleasure.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.